Screen Time with John Fardy.
Thanks to Eritainment, a new era in Irish streaming begins. Discover more at eritainment.com.
This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, the one and only Paul Mescal on Gladiator 2 and all that it means to him. I'll also be talking to the brothers Washington, yes, John David Washington and Malcolm Washington, on their new movie, The Piano Lesson, which is in cinemas and hits Netflix next week. And Aoife Barry will be here with the week's new movie and TV releases. If you want to get in touch with me, John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud or wherever you get your podcasts. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Good weekend to you all, and I hope you're doing well as the year hurtles along towards its conclusion. I had a good week. I had one of those weeks where everything seemed to go on time. I'm not saying great things happened, but everything kind of worked. You know, one of those weeks where people showed up at the right time, no car broke, no child got sick, everything went more or less as planned. I know you should never say that out loud because I'm going to get up from here and, you know, my car will be on fire or something. But, you know, sometimes you got to appreciate just the fact that things work, as opposed to things being great or amazing, just that everything worked, you know? Take comfort in the workingness of life sometimes. Now, come on, we better get to it. So I'm going to twist things this week slightly in that I want to start with movies. We usually start talking about TV. We'll do that later in the show when we talk about Bad Sisters, which has returned this week on Apple TV. But the big movie event of the week is unquestionably this.
The greatest temple Rome ever built, the Colosseum, because this is what they believe in. Power. They gather here to watch the strong strike down the weak.
There has to be something else.
There is nothing else.
There has to be another Rome.
There is no other Rome. The dream? The dream of Rome? It's an old man's fantasy.
Who are you? What was your name before you traded it for a Roman one?
You'll never know. I have a destiny.
The gods delivered you to me. You will be my instrument.
I will never be your instrument in this life or the next.
Ah, yes. Our own Paul Mescal. And indeed, Denzel Washington there. From the much-waited, desired, long-talked-about Gladiator 2, it's back. Nearly a quarter of a century later, we are back in ancient Rome, and Maximus's son, Lucius, played by Paul Mescal, and you may remember from the first movie all that time ago, he was exiled and abandoned for his own safety by his mother, Connie Nelson. That's in the first movie. He's now a man living off the soil in peace with his wife. That wouldn't make for much of a movie. So the Roman army descend, and his wife is killed during a battle, and Lucius is enslaved and is sold into gladiatordom, let's say. And lo and behold, he becomes a pretty good gladiator, and he's kind of been mentored and owned by Denzel Washington, who's brilliant in this, who's a very rich man and kind of has eyes on building his own political empire, and he's mentoring Paul Mescal's character, Lucius, and sees that he has a kind of rage similar to that his father had, which might just make him a great gladiator. There's two brilliant Roman empires in this one, Joseph Quinn and Fred Hechinger. They play twins who are in charge of Rome, and they're horrible, but great to watch in equal measure. And Paul Mescal does lots of gladiating in it. And there are brilliant epic battle scenes in it. There's one where it's not a spoiler to say, but the Colosseum is flooded and there's a water battle. There's a brilliant opening set piece even before we get to the main action. Pedro Pascal's involved, who's very good in it. So you might have heard about this, you know, differing reviews of it, largely positive. For my take, this is a swashbuckling fun 2 hours and 40 minutes. People are kind of intimating he's not as good as Russell Crowe. No one was ever going to be, but I think Paul Mescal really passes mustard in this, I have to say. And he looks like a gladiator. So I got to sit down with Paul Mescal earlier in the week. Well, it was actually last week, if you really must know, because he talks about going to see Ireland v New Zealand. I wonder how that worked out. So I spoke to him last Friday in Croke Park. Do I have to give Paul Mescal an introduction? I know I've been saying that lately, but I just think these people, you know, you want to tell you about Normal People, the seven movies he's been in, the kind of cultural phenomenon he's become. I'll tell you what I love about Paul Mescal. He's a very famous Irish person who does us proud, I would say, because he's never really said or done anything that you go, oh man, no, you're on the Irish stage, don't do that. So I think he's pretty cool. I've met him a few times. He's a lovely guy. So here's my chat with Paul Mescal about Gladiator 2 and a bit more besides. Oh, and there are one or two naughty words in this that I didn't want to add out because they make a lot of sense. Nice to see you.
You too.
Congratulations. You know, I've seen the seven movies you've been in now.
It is seven.
I checked.
Jesus.
Yeah, I know. There you go.
There we go.
Lucky I stopped by to remind you. And they've all been great, but there's never been as much expectation in any of the other ones. They've been unusual movies in some ways, and they were kind of upon us before we knew a lot of the time.
Yeah.
This one the world knew about a long time beforehand. Have you managed to park that and just do the job? Or, you know, honestly, at any stage in your hotel room or your trailer at night, were you thinking, God, this is Gladiator?
The landing in Morocco probably 3 or 4 weeks before, I always find that junction, regardless of the scale of the film, that moment when you get off the plane, close the hotel room door behind you, and I'm not the first actor to say that. That's the moment when you feel the smallest, because you're like, where am I? What am I doing? And then it's magnified somewhat by the scale of Gladiator. But that feeling that you have to remind yourself was rooted in the fact that you care deeply about it. If I was landed into a hotel room, I was like, okay, what will I do now? Well, like, I think it's just indicative of the fact that it matters. But
yeah.
I think there is an expectation with this film, and with all due respect to this film, I care so much about this film, but I care equally about All of Us Strangers and After Sun. It doesn't matter to me how big a film is, because I think the minute you put your name to something, it's got to matter equally.
Yeah.
But that also means that I care about this as much as I care have cared about anything else.
Yeah.
And I think that attitude is useful, because it does help you kind of remove the unnecessary noise.
Yeah.
Because you can't play the scale of this film when you're on set. You just have to approach it like you would anything else.
Yeah, I can imagine. Tell me this, Ridley Scott, I interviewed him once, and
he's great crack, isn't he?
Well, it's funny you should say that, because I said to him, so, and it was for The Last Duel, and I said, so why did you film in Ireland? And he said, for the tax. Simple as.
Yeah, thought, but he's a straight shooter.
And that's what I was, is he a straight shooter? He seems like John Wayne on set,
he's,
or someone.
Like, there's just, you're never in the dark about what he's thinking.
Yeah.
Both positively and not only positively, because you don't want the minute, because it means the minute he is saying something with an intention for you to change something, you understand it.
Yeah.
But also, if he says, no, that's great, I'm happy to move on, you believe it.
Yeah.
So you're not kind of trying to read the lines between him at any moment.
Yeah.
And trust is the most vital kind of aspect between an actor and a director.
So he doesn't keep things to himself. If
doesn't
he's got
keep
a problem,
things to himself. You'll know about it, and if he's happy with something, you'll know about it. That's ultimately all you want.
Does he shout action loudly?
He shouts it over the radio.
Okay,
like, action. Yeah.
Lots of people have probably talked about your physical bulking up and getting into great shape. Not that you weren't in great shape and all that, and the usual caveats apply. Not that I'm saying you weren't in great shape. But the physicality of it, like rowing the boat, the fight scenes, was it like, did you get into bed at night go...
Yeah, your body's in bits.
Yeah.
Because of the way that he shoots, it's not like you're shooting one setup in a fight. You're shooting the entire fight the whole way through, because you're picking it up on different... It's not like you're going to set up and then do one.
Yeah.
You're doing, if it's a 2.5 minute fight, you're doing a 2.5 minute fight and then you're resetting, and it's... Some days it was 39 degrees, 40 degrees. So it's hot. But there is something kind of like weirdly massive, like...
Masochistic
about it, where you like get into bed and you feel like... Because maybe that's that kind of chip on the shoulder thing that sometimes you feel as an actor that you'd like, it's all a bit cushy, and sometimes it is. Yeah. But there is something nice about going to work and acting and getting into bed and going like, well,
yeah,
my body's fairly wrecked now.
I heard Denzel, your co-star, yeah, once say that, you know, this isn't hard. I used to be a garbage man. That's hard.
That's so, yeah. I think it's tied to the same,
yeah,
to the same thing, because there is a definite privilege that comes comes with this job, for sure. So any excuse for your body to feel tired feels like the feels like the punishment that you want to deliver upon yourself.
Relieves the guilt.
Yeah, it relieves the guilt somewhat, yeah.
Yeah. I spoke to you the last time for All of Us Strangers.
Yeah.
And you were with your good friend Andrew Scott.
Yeah.
And what was abundantly clear, not just when I spoke to you, but all that day around, you were such good pals.
Yeah.
And you talked about, because my station put a clip of you saying it up, and I've lived with it for about 3 months.
Cause what
that's,
was it?
That's the power you have, saying, I missed him when he left, when we, yeah, were doing these junkets together. You're flying solo the last
flying
few days.
Solo, yeah.
How's that going for you? Because I you enjoy the camaraderie.
I do enjoy the camaraderie, and like, it's been wonderful. Like, Denzel and Connie have been out, and I'm particularly close with Fred Heckinger, who plays one of the Emperors. So I'm looking forward to seeing him in London again.
Yeah.
But it's the nature of the beast. Like, I haven't actually led. I would argue that every other part that I've played hasn't been the lead of a film. This is like my chair to lift in that sense. Like,
okay,
I have to be out in front of it, and I'm happy to be out in front, yeah, of it. So it's a different job.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good way of putting it. There was huge stuff yesterday at the premiere, and it,
yeah,
you seemed not overwhelmed, but you were taken aback by
just
how
really
many people.
Like, I wasn't, yeah. I think it would be insane to assume that that was going to happen.
Yeah.
Like, it would be crazy leaving the hotel and being like, that's what Smithfield's going to look like because I'm coming to premiere. If that was happening, I'd need a like good solid gut check and like a slap on the wrist.
Yeah.
So I'm honestly delighted that that is how my body responds to that, because I think,
yeah,
it would make me nervous if that wasn't true.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But what I was going to say to you was, and you might have heard, there was this lookalike competition.
Yeah, I heard it.
And
it,
you've,
yeah,
been coming. I was talking to Olivia Colman, and she was balking at the idea of her being a national treasure, but you're becoming that. And I'll tell you why, and I want you to tell me what you think. Irish people, when you get very famous, they do root for you.
Yeah.
And I think we're secretly praying no one messes up. And you've managed not to say anything ridiculous since you've been famous, or been found doing something that looks really, I don't know, unpleasant.
Yeah.
Do you have a sense of that, that maybe people are proud of the fact that...
I don't know what, like, I first and foremost feel like a huge sense of, I think it helps that I actually do love the place that I come from.
Mm.
I think if people see anything, I hope they see that.
Yeah.
But I also think that I hope that the version that I present in the world is the version that my friends and family know, and I don't preach to be like a role model or anything like that, but I am proud of where I come from, and what you see, I hope, is what you get.
Yes.
But I think it's a dangerous avenue to go down where you start becoming precious about how you are in the world. Like, you hope to be dignified and all of those things, but you've also got to realize that to be an actor, you've got to like live your life outside it as,
yeah,
well.
Yeah, and, yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
it's just a better way to live as well.
Yeah, indeed. You know? It probably makes you better an actor.
I think so. Yeah, yeah, for sure.
So I the last two times, and I'm repeating, this is the third time I've asked you this question, but I said to you, are you getting to take a break? You know,
yeah, yeah.
And it's funny, right? Let me tell you, the first two times I met you, I got a tiredness off you,
yeah,
that I could feel this guy needs to take a break. And I, yeah, said that to you both times. You said, don't worry, I'll sleep when I'm dead. You actually seem slightly more energized.
That's
this time. There you,
mad,
go.
I'm more tired now than I think I've ever been. But
so you haven't taken a break?
No. But what am I going to do? Turn around to Ridley and be like, no, I can't do Gladiator because I'm tired. Like, that would be fucking mad. I think, I don't know. I don't know what the answer to that is. I think the root of what you're saying is totally right, but I'm not ready to take a break,
okay,
yet.
Yeah. Yeah.
My body's ready to take a break, yeah, but that's only half of it.
Okay.
You know.
Yeah.
I'll take. Just. I feel like I'm talking to my father. It's like just.
I know. I'm sorry.
Just
I'm
five.
Sorry.
Just no. Just five more minutes. Like, it's like trying to stay up for five more minutes.
Am I technically old enough to be your father? Sorry. Let's not get into that. Tell me this. With sports a big thing in your life?
Yeah.
What's your favorite sport?
I mean, Gaelic football is the one that I played the most. I think rugby at the moment in Ireland is a huge thing in the country, and the Irish team are doing exceptionally well. I'm watching the, I don't know when this is coming out, but I'm going to watch the Ireland-New Zealand match.
Yeah,
so that's going to be exciting.
And I should have Googled this, but I didn't, because I just wanted to watch the movie and meet you. Do you have a preferred English Premier League team?
I don't.
Okay.
I'm moving up to North London, so I have a feeling it'll be have to be Arsenal, but I don't necessarily, but to be honest, I don't watch it. I don't find it interesting.
I was going to say Everton.
We'll just say Everton.
Yay!
We'll just say Everton. I couldn't care less.
We can cut the
Brian's a Liverpool supporter, so he won't be happy with that.
Listen, lovely to see you again.
Thanks very much. Great to see you.
You take a rest.
I will.
None of my business.
No. See you later. Great to see you.
Paul Mescal there, not signing up to be an Everton fan. I thought I had him on the hook there, but that person he was referring to, I think, was the cameraman in the corner, who's a Liverpool fan, so he wasn't able to subscribe to Everton. Maybe I'll try the next time we get to speak to him. Gladiator 2 is now in cinemas, I should have said, but you're probably aware of that. If you are looking for an entertaining movie to watch on the big screen this weekend, I think it's the only one out, more or less. There are other movies currently in the cinema, but it is a great, great watch. You will be very entertained by it. You absolutely will. That was Paul Mescal on Gladiator 2, which, as I say, is in cinemas now. Now, some other big stars after the break in the form of Malcolm Washington and John David Washington on their movie The Piano Lesson. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time, News Talks TV and Movie Show. Before the break, we were talking about Gladiator 2. After the break, which is now, we have passed the break. We are now in the second part of Screen Time. We're going to talk about this.
Bernice ain't going to sell that piano because her daddy died over it.
All that's in the past. If my daddy had seen where he could have traded that piano and for some land of his own, he wouldn't be sitting up here now. He spent his whole life farming somebody else's land. I ain't gonna do that. See, he couldn't do no better. When he come along, he ain't had nothing to build on. His daddy ain't had nothing to give him. The only thing my daddy had to give me was that piano. And he died giving me that. And I ain't gonna let it just sit there and rot without trying to do something with it. And if buddies can't see that, I'm gonna go and sell my hair.
That was a clip from The Piano Lesson, which comes from the play by August Wilson. And you might think I've never heard of August Wilson, but you will be very familiar with two of his plays that were made into movies, one being Ma Rainey's Black Bottom and the other one being Fences, for which Denzel Washington won an Academy Award, or was certainly nominated. I'm not sure if he won for that. He was nominated for Fences, if I'm not mistaken. And August Wilson is an august, if I may make that somewhat pun, or if that's even a pun, playwright who wrote some great American plays about, I suppose, the African-American experience in the 1920s, 30s and 40s during the Great Depression. And The Piano Lesson is an adaptation of his third play in that kind of trilogy. A character called Boy Willie Charles, played by John David Washington, has returned to his uncle's Pittsburgh home in the middle of the night with a plan. He wants to buy back the land on which his enslaved ancestors worked. But to do that, he's going to have to sell the family piano. So his uncle, played by Samuel Jackson, warns him against it. His widowed sister, played by Danielle Deadwyler, reminds him images of their ancestors are carved into the piano. And there's these kind of arguments about whether or not they should sell this piano that has, you know, their enslaved ancestors carved onto the piano. So it's a very play-like kind of movie, but the action does move around. We have John David Washington playing Willie Boy, and John David Washington, great actor from everything like Tenant to Black Klansman. He was in a movie on Netflix a couple of years ago that I really enjoyed called Malcolm and Marie. It was directed by his brother, Malcolm Washington. It's his first feature. These, by the way, you should know, their dad is Denzel Washington, who is actually the producer on this movie. So it's very much a family affair. They also have a sister called Olivia Washington. So I got to talk to John David Washington and Malcolm Washington earlier in the week about The Piano Lesson, which I should say is currently in cinema. So it's getting a cinema release, which is always leading you to believe they think there might be some awards contention. And then it will land on Netflix next week on the 22nd of November. And as I say, I spoke to John David and Malcolm Washington earlier in the week. I should say, there was a technical issue right before the interview started, so that's why I'm sitting so close to the microphone, as you will hear now. Hello, gentlemen. Lovely to see you.
Good to see you as well. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Forgive me for sitting so close. I had microphone issues earlier, and I'm afraid something's going to go wrong. So if I look like an obsessive fan, I'm not actually that crazy. Malcolm, if I can start with you, you know, as an Irish guy, I'm not that aware of August Wilson, but I have seen Fences and I have seen Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, the two movies, and I thought they were brilliant. But I'm wondering, as an American, did he loom large in your consciousness and you thought, God, if I ever make a movie, I'm going to do the third play about the piano? Or what was the motivation?
So specific. Yeah,
it may not be like that.
He was definitely a figure that looms large. The legacy is long with him, and you feel connected to his work, but it's the kind of thing that you never imagined that you would get to do professionally or on a big stage at all. To have the opportunity to work on a project like this was just a dream.
Yeah. And John David, your character, you know, you could see him in all sorts of ways, you know, and I don't want to give too much of a spoiler, but he has a view on the piano that's mercantile, let's say. He wants to put it to use, you know, and maybe get back what he thinks is his and start a life and build something for himself. So that's kind of noble, but you can also see it as he's messing with the family heritage. So in terms of you playing him, like, where do you see him? Like, are you on his side, or do you get him, or do you think, no, man, you got it wrong?
No, man. Good question. As John David, I definitely understand, you know, what he's trying to do. He's, you know, the American dream to purchase land and cultivate it into generational wealth. And he's doing that on the very land that his bloodline suffered from, you know, and he's trying to elevate his family in 1936. He's like saying, hey, family, I know what Wi-Fi is. Like, come on, there's money here. You know, so I love that. How he goes about it, I'm skeptical of. I judge him on, like, but I think that contention is rooted out of love and want and communion. I think that's what he's really going for. He just misses his family. He's been in isolation for so long in Parchment Farm, which he didn't even know he was going to survive that. So he has all these experiences that led up to the moment when we see him appear at the doorstep in Pittsburgh. And so that energy and his ferociousness, I think, is bred out of his experiences that led up to that point.
Yeah. And Malcolm, you know, I mentioned I'm an Irish guy. So it took me a while for my ear to adjust to the dialect, to like 1950s Pittsburgh. Like, did you do a lot of work on making how the characters sound real, or was it all in the play?
I think that everybody came in with an understanding of what the world that we were inhabiting was. And I think Mr. Wilson's dialogue produces a certain kind of performance, because there's a really musical element to it, and we wanted that to sing, but we also wanted to ground the film and make something that people outside of his community could see themselves in and engage with and understand, and just a certain kind of realism we wanted to the film, because we're going to take so many the big genre swings, and we're going to push it, the supernatural elements of it, we were going to push on the edges there, that I was really interested in having some grounding there. And I think that all the actors came with such a great preparation before, and everybody was in the same movie and connected to each other. So it worked out.
Let me ask you this about the family thing. You know, I have a brother. I have three children, two of whom are boys, and I could never imagine them. They're a bit younger than you, but the idea of them working on anything together seems insane. Now, I know you have a unique family dynamic in that, you know, there's a lot of actors in the family, but is it strange to work with your brother, you know, like he tells you what to do?
That's not how it went.
Oh, you're gonna act right for the I see. We'll go with that. No, I mean, I personally, I've said this before. I really didn't look at it that way. I'm a fan of Malcolm, you know, the director. I'm a fan of the artist, to be honest. The family member's been waiting on him to like do your feature. Like, let's go for it. Oh, you want to do this one though? Like, whoa. All right. So I was excited to run through a brick wall for my director, who I'm a fan of. This collaboration, this, the way his mind works, the way he knows film. He's, you know, he literally has a master's in it. So it's like, I'm just a fan of how his mind works, how he sees cinema, why it's so important to him, telling this story in particular. That's what excited me. So the brother stuff kind of was like left by the wayside during the filming. Now I also say, like, during the rollout and this press stuff, I'm feeling more of the brother element. Big time.
I'm getting a sense of it as well, yeah. Tell me this, Malcolm. I didn't know, but John David said you have a master's in cinema. Yes. Do you find, you know, I sometimes find with like people who work in what I do, journalism, they do masters in journalism and then they get into a radio studio and they can't pick up a telephone to you know, or drop a mic like I just did there, you know?
That was right on cue.
Yeah, I know. It was almost like I planned it. But do you find that stuff helps you as a filmmaker? Maybe I'm being a bit anti-academic there, but I'm wondering what your take on it is. Like when you sit down to corral all these people, you know, on a sound stage and make a movie that's 2 hours long, does that stuff go out the window or do you use it, what you learned in college?
You know, I studied film for a long time and I've had also a lot of different life experiences that felt as consequential in my becoming a filmmaker as any schooling did. So I kind of think of it like Kill Bill or something, where you know in Kill Bill she has all these paths where you have to go through and learn these lessons and then you put it all together for the final boss. So for me myself, like where I was started and where I was trying to get to, school was like a really crucial step for me. If not for anything else, for my own confidence, to feel like, okay, I deserve to take a shot at this. I owe it to myself to really try and make something with.
Yeah.
With.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. John David, and I suppose both of you as well, you know, I've interviewed.
Yeah, whatever.
No. I'm listening, man. I'm hung on every word. No, but you know, experience has taught me that actors coming up, if they have famous acting parents, it's the last thing they want to talk about. Rightly so. And I get that. I can understand it. So, but you've been around doing this a while. So I'm sure you won't mind me making this observation. I never think of your dad when I see you on screen, because you've got your own identity. But in this movie, I thought for the first time ever, you sounded very similar to him. Mm. Just your voice. And I've never heard that before in Tenet or anything else. Have other people mentioned that to you? Or?
Yeah, I've heard it before. I've definitely heard that.
But on this movie in particular,
no,
because I hadn't noticed it before.
Yeah, no, not on this movie. I don't think so. Not that I know of, but okay. You know, more people see it, maybe I will hear it. But I haven't heard that on this particular film, no.
Okay. Well, that must be just my strange Irish ears, you know? And listen, finally, and Netflix will be happy enough for me to mention this, because I have a real soft spot for your film, Malcolm and Marie, John David. And for a couple of reasons. One is, I saw it in lockdown. And, you know, we were in the middle of COVID, and you know, I'm presenting a film show and there was nobody to talk to because there was no movies coming out. And then Netflix got in touch and said, we have Sam Levinson and Zendaya. Do you want to talk to them? And I thought, oh my God, yes, please. That'd be great. And then I saw the movie and I loved it at the time, just because it was kind of mirroring so much. I know it's for people who don't know, it's about this movie director who comes home and kind of has a real strange evening with his partner. But I loved that movie. But I remember talking to Sam Levinson and Zendaya about the intensity of it, filmed in that one house in the middle of a pandemic. What's your memory of the filming of that?
I would concur with that. It was intense. It felt like survival. Didn't know what the business was going to look like at the time. So it felt like a miracle that we can even do this. And our producer on this, Katya Washington, was a producer on that one as well. First time I got to work with her. She's my sister. And I felt a great amount of pressure, because I've never acted in front of her, you know? And so like, and a friend who I grew up with was a still photographer. So they're watching the monitors while I'm going. I felt like I got to deliver because I'm going to make them look bad. I'm going to make us look bad in front of the dream team of Zendaya and Sam. So I felt a lot of those things that were put into the film, those experiences and what we were even experiencing through the pandemic, being able to have the right to express ourselves once again. All that was in the making of that production.
Well, listen, I will be telling people to watch The Piano Lesson. It's great. It's a fascinating watch. And you did a great job, both of you. And I hope you stay brotherly for the rest of the press junket, because I know these things can be tough as a brother myself. But nice to talk to you guys.
Thank you.
Brothers John David Washington and Malcolm Washington talking to me about their brotherly relationship and, of course, and their life and times and their movie, The Piano Lesson, which is in cinemas now and is on Netflix from next week, the 22nd of November. And John David Washington stars in it and Malcolm Washington directed it. And they are, of course, brothers and indeed children of Denzel Washington. But John David Washington is very much a famous actor in his own right, as Malcolm Washington is a famous director in his own right. Now, Aoife Barry will be here after the break to review some of the week's new TV and cinema releases. Now, you're welcome back to the last part of Screen Time. Now, here's the Garvey sisters at the races.
Don't pity me.
Hi, I found a doggy.
She has three kids, FYI.
That's not true. One's an adult.
Oh, I don't give a shit.
I'm just going to steal her away now.
Oh.
It's all right.
Mind your little noggin now, jumping all those tall fences. Some fruits. Oh, my
God. We got the champers.
Oh.
So she was too small.
How's champagne?
So, what's the plan?
Out of fun, so out of fun.
Aww.
What the hell? Where'd you get that?
In a three-way on cherry pop.
It's golden each way.
Whatever. I won 500 quid.
Oh, my. No.
I changed my mind about the stripper.
That was a clip of Bad Sisters Season 2, which lands on Apple TV as of this week, the 13th of November. That's Wednesday. The first two episodes are up there. I've seen the first four because I'm very important. But even more important than me is arts journalist and novelist and writer. Let's call her a writer. Aoife Barry, who's seen all eight of them. And she's also seen Gladiator too. So she's been busy and she's here to tell us all. Hello, Aoife. How are you?
Hello, I'm good. How are things?
So listen, Bad Sisters 2, you know, I think it's fair to say a lot of us, and probably you included, were almost blown away by just how good the first season of Bad Sisters was. Or I certainly was. I thought it was brilliant.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. And I think that idea of it being based on a Belgian series as well, and Sharon Horgan and others kind of getting their hands on it and turning it into an Irish-based story. Like I wondered from the start how that was going to work, and it worked so well. You know, it felt like really, really Irish. It didn't feel like it was somebody else's tale that she was telling. And it was just really good crack. Like, what a cast. Like, you know, Anne-Marie Dunn, Sarah Green, Eva Birthistle, Eve Houston, Sharon Horgan, Play Spang. I mean, it was, stacked full of great people.
So far, so good. Season one's a knockout. So season two, we got word this was happening a long time ago without, you know, going into it. You've seen all eight episodes, but what loosely, where do we find the Garvey sisters?
Yeah, so we come back and we meet them 2 years after everything that happened in the first season. So enough time has elapsed that, as we know from the trailer, there's going to be a wedding of one of the sisters. So we know that she's enough time to meet somebody and fall in love and, you know, start a new relationship. But not so much time has passed that the kind of, you know, events of season one are completely in the rearview mirror. You know, like, maybe they are a little bit, people can still see them. Things are still kind of hovering over the sisters a little bit, but they are basically moving on with their lives. And I think there's a real challenge with this second season because, as people probably know, you know, like I was just saying, that it was based on the Belgian TV series Clan, but that series ended with that first series. There wasn't like the second series that we have now. So Sharon Horgan, in effect, we had to write an entirely new storyline for this second season. And I think that's a really big challenge that she was set to have to do that. So with this, you know, second season, she had to basically, I think, bring a lot of what we love from the first season, which is like the family relationships and how the sisters get on, but also bring a mystery mystery, bring maybe a murder mystery even, and bring some meddling people into it to try and also bring along that side that we also loved from the original series too.
Oh.
So we get both of those things this time around.
Yeah. And so, as you say, a very tall, you know, order to be able to repeat the success of season one. Has it succeeded, do you think?
I think for the most part, definitely. But I would say that what it lacks compared to the first one is it doesn't quite have one central, we'll say, mystery and quest, which is what you had in the first season. And I think instead you have a few different narratives happening at the same time, some of which maybe could have been removed to make things a little bit clearer. But what I did love is that what's pushed to the fore in this particular second season is the relationships between the sisters, how they're going through a lot of things that a lot of women go through in life that's not always seen on the telly. And I really like that commitment, you know, to telling stories about sisterhood, about getting older. One of the characters turns 50 and there's a lot about that in it. Things like menopause, you know, things like second marriages and even, you know, kind of what it's like to be in your 30s. So because they have a cast where the ages run from 30s into just about 50, it means that you get a lot of things explored in this. It didn't get explored in season one. So that's what really worked for me in this. And there's some really funny lines, like Sharon Horgan is just gas, like what a gift she has, you know, doesn't she, for writing comedy?
Oh yeah, they're brilliant. And I agree with you. It's there's a few more plots going on and stuff like that, but I think it gets by. But what I really like about it is that, you know, all the people you mentioned, Sarah Green, Eva Bertussel, Hewson, sorry, I should give her full name, Sharon, Eve Hewson, Sharon Horgan, Anne-Marie Duff, they're all still on wonderful form and their comic timing is excellent.
Yeah, they really are. I think they clearly get on really, really well in real life. And like, I interviewed Eva Bertussel, which is why I got to see the series in advance. And she was saying that, like, they're just really good friends with each other. You know, they all really love each other. And I think that really comes through. And like, I have two sisters myself, so I know what it's like to be in a house with multiple sisters. And they really get down the fact that, like, sometimes you just want to maybe not kill your sister. That's not a spoiler at all or anything like that. But like, the idea is sometimes you're just like, oh, for God's sake, just leave me alone. And other times like, oh, you're amazing. Just like with any familiar relationship. And I think that is really kind of brought to the fore in this. They have a really good dynamic. It's very, very sparky. And it means then that I think that provides that sort of comfort viewing, I think, for a lot of viewers. They really enjoy watching the interaction between the sisters, and that sense that some of them are a little bit wilder than others. Some of them are quiet. And with some, you just don't really know what's going to happen next. And that kind of keeps us on our toes as well, too.
And we have to mention Fiona Shaw has entered the fray. I think she's great in this. I mean, she's pretty great in everything, but she's particularly good in this.
Oh, she's so funny. And she kind of plays against type, I think, in this. Like, I'm trying to think of the last thing I saw her in. I mean, she's such an absolute icon off stage and the screen. And she really, like, plays such a funny role of a woman called Angelica in this, who becomes a thorn in the side of the sisters. But her character arc is really interesting. I think, you know, when you're watching it, you might think she's going to be one thing, and you'll see different layers to her unveiled the whole way through. Some of which are maybe followed through a little bit more than others, but she becomes this very interesting multi-layered character. And I have to give a shout out to Thalia Graham as well, who plays a new garda called Houlihan, who is so funny. She's a young Irish actress, and I swear some of the best moments, you know, in the show are between her and Barry Ward, who plays this really, you know, kind of like dry, annoyed detective who really just hates the fact that Houlihan, played by Thalia Graham, wants to do her job well, and that she's a little bit green as well, you know, and but wet around the ears, doesn't really know what she's doing. But does he know much more, even though he's more experienced? We soon find out.
No, indeed. And you said he was annoyed. He's also very annoying at times. And Thalia, people will know from playing O in Sex Education.
Yeah. And, you know, that is a series that I haven't seen a lot of. But when I was watching the series of Bad Sisters 2, I immediately started Googling Thalia Graham and saying, oh my God, what else is she in? And she's been in a fair few things to date. But I think she's somebody who's really poised for taking off. And she's definitely kind of making a quite a global career, which is great. Like, she's just brilliant. She lights up the screen.
Yeah. So I'm going to summarize what you said, and you can tell me if I've got this right. Very good. We'll keep Bad Sisters fans happy. Not as good as season one, but that was probably never possible anyway. But you tell me.
Yeah, I think that pretty much sums it up. I think that it's just different to season one. And I think it does leave things open at the end for season three. And I think maybe that might be when we might see things, you know, going to another level again, because you've kind of gone through the difficult second album and you can kind of get, you see what works, see what the audience is, you know, connected to. I think if you're going to the series for the same sort of murder mystery that you get in season one, you're not going to get what you had the last time. But if you go to it for the relationships between the sisters, for some really funny lines, for some really, really poignant and sad moments as well as the kind of the high points of it, then you'll get all that too there. And I think people are really still going to really enjoy the series for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I agree with you wholeheartedly, I have to say. I don't think it was ever going to be as good as season one, but in the four episodes I watched, I found it very watchable and pleasant and poignant at times as well. So that's largely a thumbs up from Aoife Barry for Bad Sisters 2, which is available, the first two episodes on Apple TV and then dropping weekly, which I kind of think is always a good sign. And you may notice, eagle-eared listeners, Aoife said telly, which I like, because let's not forget it was the telly and it will end as the telly, whatever about your smart TVs or any of that stuff. Now, Aoife, listen, you're double jobbing because I happened to see you at a screening of Gladiator 2 last week. And when I was booking you to come on and talk about Bad Sisters 2, I said, let's talk about Gladiator while you're there. So tell me, what did you make of it?
God, that is the question that's on every single film lover's lips at the moment. I've talked to so many people who's like, have you seen Gladiator? What do you think of it? Everybody is dying to know what people think about this. Overall, I thought this was a real kind of epic, a really big, bloody, you know, spectacle. I thought that, like, it really showed that Ridley Scott knows what people want to see on screen in terms of like a big popcorn film right now. Just as I think he knew what people wanted to see back in 2000 with the original Gladiator, which is quite different to this. Like, I think both of them show the two sides to, not the two sides, but show how cinema has evolved, I think. This is a lot bigger, a lot bolder. We can get into the Paul Mescal end of things, but I will say my hero in this is Denzel Washington.
Oh, he's
just
wonderful.
Is a reason to go to see this film on its own.
So what did you make of Paul's performance?
Do you know, I felt that the key, I think, with the first Gladiator, because I rewatched it before I watched Gladiator 2, because I wanted to kind of reconnect with what the hell happened in the film. And, you know, I think that Russell Crowe, obviously, he won the Oscar for the role. There's something really deep about his character in that film that people really connect to, because he's lost everything. And so he has nothing really left to lose, but he wants to avenge the huge losses in his life. And there's all these layers in the film about like the afterlife and this idea of, not even layers, actually, they're quite overt. This idea of the afterlife and him getting to the afterlife to find his loved ones. And you really feel for him. Like, I, you know, you feel his loss, and you're with him as he steps into the Colosseum. You're with him as he's kind of beating the head around people. And then you're with him at the very sad ending to that film as well, too. So his character arc is really poignant, I think. And then you also get people, like, you know, tearing strips off each other as well too, if you're into that sort of thing. And even though the character that Paul Mescal plays, Lucius, who, you know, it turns out is Maximus's, Russell Crowe's character's son, according to the second film, wasn't quite overt in the first one, even though he too suffers a loss of the film, that's like the motivation behind what he does for the rest of the film, I felt like the script didn't give him a huge amount to do in order to portray the loss and the feeling and the emotion. And I was just missing that emotional connection with his character that I think I got with Russell Crowe. But I think he really is great in the action scenes. Like, he's a real like physical, you know, presence on screen, and he really holds his own. There's no weakness, I think, in any of his physicality and how he treats and the kind of action scenes. And that is the key to Gladiator in many ways, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do you believe this guy can actually beat every single person? And do you believe he can kind of fight to the death? And you do believe that with Paul Mescal's portrayal of Lucius.
But you're saying you'd like to have seen him slightly more revenge driven, or that there was more revenge and more bad stuff had happened to him to make him an angrier opponent?
I think I'd like, I don't know about you, did you find just the script, I felt some of the lines he was given just were really like, you know, they were just two or three word lines that didn't really give him a lot to play with. And so I felt like he didn't have that moment where he got to have anything kind of interesting to say, even though there's a lot of stuff that was kind of happening ostensibly to him that you could understand the motivation. I think the script overall, you know, on the film wasn't really maybe amazing for a lot of the characters. But then in contrast, you had like a character like Denzel Washington who did have some really great lines. So for me, there was kind of moments of, okay, not really enjoying this. And then moments of, you know, you saw the two emperors played by Joseph Quinn and Fred Hechinger, who are just you know, they like eat the screen and they're awful and you hate them and you're really, you understand your terrible emotions towards them from the moment they're on screen. And that's really enjoyable. So it definitely had its moments that I really like had such a ball. And then other times I thought, oh, I'd love a little bit more here. I'd love this to be a little bit less maybe cliched in terms of the lines that Mescal is given.
Interesting. I hadn't thought of it. You see, we sat down to watch that. It was 2 hours and 40 minutes and it flew by. Mm-hmm. And I get what you're saying, maybe about the emotional depth of the first one, but it was swashbuckling entertainment with goodies and baddies for 2.5 hours or 2 hours and 40 minutes that carried me the whole way.
Yeah, it really is. Like, I mean, I think it's that thing as well. It's like, you know, when you're analyzing something as like a reviewer or a critic, you're always kind of picking up on stuff that maybe when you're just going to cinema to enjoy a film, you're like, oh, I don't mind whether his script isn't, the lines aren't brilliant or whatever, you know, like there's huge amount to the film to really, really enjoy. And like, we both saw it on IMAX. And I think you'd agree that like seeing it on the biggest screen you can possibly see,
oh, yeah,
how you have to see this. Like, this is not a small screen film. And also, you know, did you enjoy the fact that like it gets into the action really, really quickly? Like there's this opening battle and you have all these ships coming in on the sea into this kind of fortified town. And like that immediately I find that really, really exciting to watch. It was like, you kind of had like the hairs are lifting on your arms, you know, I think watching that scene.
Yeah, and I also like the fact that there were one or two moments of, uh-oh, things are about to get serious, where like he's staring up at Pedro Pascal from the auditorium. There was a couple of moments with Denzel that were kind of slightly spine tingling. So I loved it for the most part as a swashbuckler. What are you going to say stars-wise for Gladiator 2?
I think like I'd give it a 4 because I think it delivers on a lot of what you want out of it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not like, oh, you know, it's not trying to be some emotional excavation or some like, you know, exactly correct rendition of, you know, history and exactly what happened to the Roman Empire. Like, do you know what I mean?
Not that.
Like, you know, maybe they had hippos in the Colosseum and maybe they did, you know, flood it with water. Like, it's not trying to be, it is swords and sandals epic, but it's like, it's more than that. So yeah, I think it really gives you a huge amount of what you want. And you get to see an Irish actor who's under 30 in like probably the biggest, if not like definitely one of the absolute biggest films of the year, if not the biggest film. And like, that's a real moment of national pride, I think, too. So they can have that as well from us.
Absolutely. Well, earlier in the show, as I interviewed Paul Mescal, I did describe him as a national treasure. So make of that what you will. But I go along with the 4 stars. So Aoife Barry and myself, but most importantly, Aoife Barry gives Gladiator 2 4 stars. And of course, Gladiator, in case you didn't know, is very much in cinemas now. Aoife, thanks a million.
Thank you so much.
Aoife Barry there giving me her thoughts on Gladiator 2. And also Bad Sisters Season 2 on Apple TV. That's it for this week. Next week on the show, I'm going to be talking to Lindsay Lohan and some of her co-stars from a new Christmas movie, Our Little Secret. I'm also going to be talking to the great Bill Nighy about his new movie, Joy, which is all about kind of the world's first test tube baby. Fascinating story. So that's all to come on another packed show next week. In the meantime, if you want to get in touch with me at any stage during the week about movies or TV or anything at all, you can email us screentime@newstalk.com. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Enjoy the remainder of your weekend, have a safe week ahead, and I'll talk to you all next week.
Screen Time with John Fardy.
Thanks to Airtainment.
Saturdays at 6 p.m. on Newstalk.